This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Alexis Santos, an assistant professor of human development and family studies at Penn State. Alexis co-published The Use of Death Counts from Vital Statistics to Calculate Excess Deaths in Puerto Rico Following Hurricane Maria, a research letter published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association. The letter was one of several estimates released over this summer that called into question past estimates of Hurricane Maria-related deaths. It received tremendous attention and became a point of political friction in the national conversation. It's a pleasure to have you join us, Alexis. Thank you for coming.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. Thanks for having me.
So for the benefit of our listeners who only know the broad contours of what happened in Puerto Rico, can you start off with a little background on Hurricane Maria? What happened in the hurricane and why do death counts matter so much?
Oh, sure. So back in September 20 last year, Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico. And one of the first things that hinted that this was going to be a hurricane like no other was that it tore apart the Doppler radar that is used to monitor weather.
Oh.
So just the first gust of wind destroyed the Doppler radar.
Wow.
And there was no climate information being pulled into the cloud that would be AccuWeather or Weather Channel. So down the road, you know, September 22, and even more days after, a lot of us couldn't reach our family members. And it really became a moment like no other because my town is really close to San Juan. My mom is a nurse. And when I got a hold of my mom, who is a very strong person and she never lets out her, you know, a lot of details in conversations, she couldn't stop talking about the devastation she saw, about the situations that she was seeing in the hospital, of people pretty much bringing bedridden patients and leaving them in the hospital because if I keep my parent here, he or she is going to die for sure. So I'm just going to drop them off at the hospital and see if they can keep them alive. So a lot of the things I've heard, not only from my mom, but from first responders, hinted at me that this was a really big tragedy. Down the road, October 3rd, number 45 visits Puerto Rico, and he pretty much devalues and kind of dismisses the fact that this is a catastrophe and says this is not a hurricane like Katrina. And the governor tells him we only have 16 deaths certified. And that didn't sound to me as something that fit the reality. So I started looking at death records from past years to establish patterns. And once we got a hint of the information of what was happening in September and October, we produced estimates of excess deaths and we posted them in social archives. And then Vox picked it up. And then other media joined. And our numbers were pretty much the numbers that were coming out also of journalists who were doing a basic arithmetic calculations, you know, comparing to last year or comparing to 2 years ago. So, you know, having an academic institution like Penn State putting out a member of the community, I was at right there. I was in the Department of Sociology, and I was leading the Applied Demography program. It really boosted the attention because now demographers and academics are weighing in on the conversation. Hmm. And this was around, you know, at the end of November last year.
And how many? So you ran the reanalysis. The official count was how many again? 16?
16 certified on when the governor spoke with the president of the United States when he visited the island. Mm-hmm. And later on, they increased it to 64.
Okay.
But that was still not enough. That was still a vast undercount of the excess deaths.
And what did your analysis conclude was the true death number? And can you give us sort of some brief technical details on how you did it really fast?
Yes. So what we did was we used 7 years worth of data from 2010 to 2016. Mm-hmm. And we built confidence intervals around the mean of number of deaths per month. Mm-hmm. And we pretty much did a comparison of what had happened after on September, October, November, December. And what we found was that there were about 1,100 deaths above historical level, mm-hmm. Taking in consideration that we're not comparing with averages. We're comparing with the uppermost limit of a confidence interval. Mm-hmm. And that then the number 64 was pretty much 15 times lower than that it should have been.
No. And what was the follow? What happened? So Vox picked up your, so you posted a social archive, which I'm happy to underscore.
Yeah.
Vox picks it up. And then what happened?
We got a little bit of pushback from the Puerto Rico government. For one thing that was said by the lead politician who was leading who was dealing with the topic, the Department of Public Safety lead, he said he needs to give me a list of names of people he thinks died.
Oh my goodness!
And yeah, that was my reaction. I wish I could have laughed back then, but I said, right, "This is ridiculous. How can he expect me to have this information? I'm just doing simple arithmetical functions here. I don't have a roster of names."
Right.
But that was sort of the way they pivoted. It was saying, "Hey, if you are saying it's 1,000, you need to give us the list of thousands." And then, of course, the social media became kind of a battleground, because I was getting a lot of pushback from people who were saying, "Oh, you're just supporting fake news, blah blah blah. You're making the governor look bad, and he's saving lives." So both from the political and the other spectrum, I was receiving a lot of pushback to the result. And, you know, I became a public scholar kind of by accident, if you can call it that. The topic drove me to being open to talking with more people. And, you know, I started receiving calls in my office that I didn't know how to handle. Because, you know, I would get a call from a friend of mine who went with me to high school that I haven't spoken to in years. And she said, "Alexis, my mom just died. And her death certificate says she died because of diabetes, and she's not diabetic. She died because of the hurricane." So I had to deal with a lot of situations that I would dare say that I have a little bit of political training, but I was not ready for just such the pushback. And then came later on, I had a couple of emails that I received of people actually asking me for my data because they wanted to do their own projects.
Sure.
And, you know, it's kind of like, I'm a junior scholar. Let me publish this, man. But yeah, journals, actually, the reason why I reached Social Archives was because a couple of colleagues from sociology here at Penn State had used Social Archives to share their papers. And because I had sent this for speed review in a couple of medical journals, and it was death rejected. And ultimately, we were able to later on run the numbers, and we were pretty much spot on with the analysis we did in November. But, you know, then also came some resistance, because who is this young kid? You're not a physician to determine causes of death. And so it was just a difficult period. But, you know, I tried to stick to the science and see how things fared out.
So I have a question, right? I actually, like, when I first read your study, my first reaction was, why haven't we always been having both of these counts when we have these disasters in the first place? Like having, okay, these are the deaths that people say, these are the direct deaths related to the hurricane, and then also the number, right, estimating excess mortality that, you know, that may not have been the direct result of the hurricane, but, you know, but definitely you could say wouldn't have happened had the hurricane not occurred.
Yeah.
Why do we have both numbers?
Well, actually, the CDC guidelines to determining deaths related to the hurricane contemplate both. You know, it contemplates people who drown, people who fall from a roof, people who are killed because, you know, they get the flying debris hit them, and it also includes deaths that were caused because of deteriorating health conditions in the face of, for example, infrastructure-dependent people who need a machine for dialysis or who need a machine to breathe or to, you know, the CDC guidelines are very broad in how this is done. And that was the first thing I did, was just check the CDC guidelines to see how they were. And I think the big issue here was when Katrina happened, there's this quote by the mayor of New Orleans saying, I think 10,000 persons died. Mm-hmm. Those were his first words. Mm. And that triggered a lot of responses. But when the when the president of the United States went to Puerto Rico, the governor told him, oh, nobody died, only 16. Mm. And so that, I think, was what triggered most of the interest in the topic. It was because the official narrative was not in line with reality.
How did your peers respond to you getting attention?
Actually, my peers were instrumental. During my time at the Department of Sociology and Criminology here at Penn State, I have really supportive colleagues who I can pretty much call friends. And they would, you know, come by, check in that I was doing well. They would say, like, how are you handling this? So they helped me a lot. I also, even though the paper was not peer-reviewed by a journal, I can pretty much say that peers had read it before I posted it.
Sure.
And you know, I had, like, I was sharing a house with one of my colleagues last year, and we just went up over to him. He was writing something. I said, like, can you read this and tell me if it makes sense? Hmm. So it had some level of scrutiny by colleagues and friends. And, you know, the getting attention was difficult because I'm not trained for this.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it was a very positive experience. People were very happy.
Yeah, and another thing that that actually your piece made me think about was, you know, there seems to be, or there has been, a movement amongst medical sociologists and also demographers who are interested in mortality, in thinking about how death certificates and cause of death put down on death certificates, the ways in which maybe we should be rethinking the way in which these things are, or that final decision is made in the first place. There's this idea that there may be under or overcounts in terms of the cause of death of people from specific demographic groups, mostly because, you know, whoever it is that's signing the death certificate may say, well, you know, these people tend to die of this thing and you exhibit the symptoms. And so this is actually what we say the cause of death is, when in reality, it might not actually be the cause of death. And so I actually think that your piece actually opens up this much broader conversation about, you know, how do we number one count deaths? How do we figure out mortality rates? And how do we more objectively think about cause of death on our death certificates?
Yes, there's a big movement right now with people who are starting to study multiple causes of death.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a topic that I haven't gotten into myself. But, you know, the death certificate is what I've heard. I haven't been, I don't have the responsibility of filling one, right? But I've heard from physicians that it's a very complicated document to fill out. And it takes time. It takes about an hour to fill a certificate to its fullest. And following the hurricane, one of the big issues that I've identified in Puerto Rico, and later on the data supported it, was that they were not conducting autopsies on all the bodies. Mm-hmm. So the determination of causes of death were exactly as you said. The physician said, oh, she had a fever and blah, blah, blah. So this was the cause. It was an infection. And the other thing was that when they were, that the processes were not being done the way they should have been done, because the physicians had to make the decision of spending 1 hour filling the death certificate or spending that hour providing care to another person who was still alive.
Yeah, uh-huh. Totally.
So, it's emergency conditions do really pose a challenge in so many ways of logistics. But that doesn't mean that down the road, the appropriate filling of this certificate is not going to have any implications, because, for example, FEMA has a program where they reimburse people if their family members die because of the hurricane. If you don't have the check mark in the box in the death certificate that says that your family member died because of this, then it is going to be really an uphill battle to get that reimbursement.
So it seems like there's two issues here in terms of the resistance to your analysis. One is, you know, just like outright juking the stats type issue, like we often see in criminology. And then the other is that people just don't fundamentally get the idea of excess mortality. And because it's tricky, right? Because you can't necessarily allocate in any particular case what the excess mortality was caused by. So a simpler example would be after 9/11, you know, all planes were grounded for a week or two.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a lot more highway miles driven, and there were a lot more highway fatalities. And I saw estimates, I don't know if they're true, but I saw estimates that almost as many people died from the excess highway mortality as died in 9/11 itself. But let's say that somebody died in a car accident on I-80 on September 15th, 2001. You can't necessarily say that that specific person and not the person who died on I-40 was, you know, killed by 9/11. Yeah. And it's something that's very hard for people to get their heads around.
Yeah. So, for example, one of the things that I've tried to do when I'm doing the numbers and crunching numbers here, have a couple of other analysis that I'm trying to get out soon on kind of like how the past trends justify that 1,000-ish number, is that you look at, for example, you mentioned 9/11, but you would think that there's a couple of circumstances that you would find in the surrounding areas that could be directly linked to 9/11. For example, these first responders who were exposed to this termite and they started developing the respiratory problems down the road or down, you know, after a couple of months. That's one case that you can make a link because they didn't have these problems before they acted as first responders and they were exposed to this situation, right? Say somebody who was in good health and because of all the stress they got, they had a heart attack. If you look at the CDC guidelines, those two deaths would actually be attributable to 9/11 because you can make a direct link between what would have happened if the event didn't happen. But, you know, driving the estimates of driving, I haven't seen them, so I wouldn't be able to comment more on it.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think we'd have to actually look closely at the methodology to establish what the number was. But I think in principle, everyone on this call would be comfortable with the idea that there was some greater than zero level of excess mortality because of flights diverted to roads. You know, now whether that excess mortality is 10 people or 4,000 people is something where we'd need to look closely at the math.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that why I started looking at this the way I was looking at it was because Puerto Rico, we don't have, or the people who are back in Puerto Rico, they don't have the ability to just jump in their cars and drive to Dominican Republic. Like they're locked in the island. And the days before the hurricane, the airports were not working that much. Mm. And because Hurricane Irma had sort of grazed the island and, you know, you have usual traffic. But I was trying to bring my mom to spend the hurricane time with me here. And the tickets were around $2,000, $3,000 when they normally go for $300. So it's a situation that causes a bottleneck situation where people are pretty much locked in the island. So that's why I said, you know, we can pretty much establish confidence intervals and we'll have a reasonable estimate of what happened. And right now, I think it's on the desk of the president right now, a bill approved by Congress to a request that the Institute of Medicine creates guidelines on how to properly account for excess mortality. So I think this is a discussion that later on is going to be we're going to be still having this discussion in a couple of years because it's going to be a 2-year period till the Institute of Medicine has to come out with specific guidelines on how to do this.
Well, the one thing I wanted to ask, Alexis, was what's next?
What's next? Oh, yes. I am right now in the process of designing a study to study health deterioration. Because, mm-hmm. of course, the dead people, we want them to rest in peace. But there are still people in Puerto Rico who are living without, with you know what they call the blue tarps. They still don't have roofs in their houses. The money that has been assigned for aid has not made it to the people yet. Mm-hmm. And so there's still people who are living as if it was September 21, 2017 still. And that ultimately has a has effects. It's added stress. What are we going to do? Probably my son left and moved to Florida. There's a couple of things that are happening that act as stressors to the population, particularly the adult and older adults. So I'm about to launch a study in a couple of weeks that is going to mirror my first study in Puerto Rico, which is going to be with online recruitment. And I got a couple of like people who have like 1 million followers on Facebook and Twitter to help me by doing promotions of the study and doing Facebook Lives. And it's pretty much going to be a survey asking people how they cope with disaster, how would they rate their health in the past, and how are they feeling right now to see if we see some health decline. And we also would and there's a couple of questions about stress, you know, levels of stress, and also how much in control they feel in their current situation compared to last year. So pretty much now I'm starting to focus on those who are still alive in Puerto Rico, because there's a couple of things coming down the pipeline that after 2020, the U.S. government is going to stop disbursing money to keep the healthcare system of Puerto Rico running. Right now, they're funding it at 100%. In 2020, they're going to stop that. And so we're going to be facing additional challenges that ultimately will affect the health of the population. And I want to get as much research on this topic as possible out, so we're ready to start initiating policy discussions on this matter down the road.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.